At this time, I'd like to introduce Reverend Gregory Wilson. His sermon topic is Hope to Carry On.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Usually around the 15th of the month, I get a notice saying, what are your sermon titles for next month? So, I know on a given occasion, I'll say, Helen, what are my sermon titles next month? What should I do? And so she said, Hope to Carry On. And I wasn't sure she was thinking about me finding my own sermon titles or that was the sermon title itself. But I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. Because that fit with talking about the last sermon. We talked about you having, what is your vision for our church? What do you see in the future for our church? What do you want for this church? And then how do we bring your individual vision for this church in dialogue with the many other visions people have for this church and work that out? And so I said, okay, that'll fit. And then I thought about hope to carry on. Usually when I think about hope to carry on, often that phrase comes from when our hopes have been diminished, when we've been battered around, when we've been in a struggle, somebody will come up and give us hope to carry on. And I thought, well, now do I talk about hope or do I talk about the struggle we need to hope for to carry on? And so on. And so as you can imagine, you taking apart a phrase like that, you can go in different directions. And then I was reminded that I spent much of my graduate work on the concept of hope. And I can remember coming to the conclusion that there were two kinds of hope, that there was the hopeful imagination period and hope for something in the future. So I thought that was special that I came up with those two kind of things. And I thought, oh, right, you know, something to write about because you're looking for things to write about. So I went to a pastoral theological seminar, and the two big pastoral theologians of the nation who write about hope were there together going to present. And I thought, oh, good, I'm going to come in there with my new idea and see how the gods of hope in the pastoral theological field talk about it. And, boy, they just couldn't hear what I had to say, and they kept shaking their heads no. But I stuck to my guns, and I think it is important, and as they talked about hope, that we have some sense of hope for the future, some sense of God for them, some sense of well-being, some sense of love in the future to help pull us through the future. And I think that's very important, and yes to that. However, if we don't have a hopeful sense of self, if we don't have a hopeful imagination, if our histories aren't stored with a sense of hope infused within them, it's been my experience that I don't care what I hope for in the future, I don't really have the energy to bring it about. Or I get thrown off a bit. Or I get distracted a bit, because the two need to go together. The sense of hope in the future and the hopeful sense of self, that they need to merge together. So I thought I'd spend some time talking about just the general disposition of hopefulness before we get into hope to carry on, which my guess will be next week. I thought I would start with reading a passage that many of you are going to be familiar with, at least the beginning of it, but my hunch is not so much the second part of it. And the first one is one that many of us have heard as maybe we took vows in a commitment to a partnership. This is a popular reading for that from the book of Corinthians. Chapter 13 talks about love. Love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it does not dishonor others, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered. Love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are speaking in tongues, they will cease, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. And when completeness comes, all of what we don't understand will come to our understanding. But here's the piece of this particular passage that I find important when we talk about having a hopeful disposition, to actually believe that the things and that the images and the visions that we have in the future can occur. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child, but when I became an adult, I put away childish things. And I thought, we ought to read that more at weddings. That we put away childish things when we make commitments to one another. Because how many of you have been in a relationship and you're looking at your partner and you're going, they're acting very childish? No, I've never said that. I may have had it come toward me. And at first, we may say yes to that. Of course, we put away childish things. Of course, we try to put away selfishness. We try to put away self-centeredness. We try to put away our narcissistic worst selves and consider the other. And of course, we say yes to those obvious things. But however, in our imaginations and in our world, in our spiritual lives, there are other things that we don't put away. For example, and I've shared this before, and some of you will remember, but maybe some of you won't, that when I was growing up, my brother was 5 years older than me, and that gave him a distinct advantage physically, not necessarily in spirit, but physically. And so I could not attack him directly, because he would win every time. And I'd behave like one day I was going to win, but I never won. So, as any smart human being would do, I had to figure out other tactics to deal with that disadvantage. So I learned to do things indirectly that would anger him. Learned to do things passive-aggressively that would anger him. I would get back. Now, some of that was conscious and some of that was not conscious. And as a child adopts adaptive patterns of life, overly pleasing to get affirmation from parent, watching an older sibling interact in a negative way with parents to learn, I'm never going to do that, so I'm going to be the good one. Codependent ways of existing, addictive ways of existing, ways that do not promote intimacy or commitment. I mean, anything that can happen in our childhood that we have to adapt in our childhood, sooner or later sinks inside of us, and we become that way as a child in order to survive. This is what we do. All of us. It's what all of us do. We adapt to our environment. And if it was problematic, then our adaptation could be problematic until we look at it. I'm saying that this particular spiritual guidance from 2 Corinthians is also addressing those issues. Those issues that I adapted, those behaviors that I took on, those ways, that way of life, those lifestyles that I took on to survive, that I bring into my adulthood. This particular passage is saying, if there's going to be love and hope, we have to put those away. Well, how do we do that? How do I become more direct with my anger? How do I become more direct with being clear about my needs in life? How do I become more direct with, if I'm in a relationship and there's a commitment going on saying, I really like this relationship, and not let the fear of commitment drive me out of the relationship? How do I say that if I'm going to try to do something to better myself, that I'm going to be more considerate of others, that I'm going to quit this addiction, that I'm going to do that, that I could actually share that with somebody even though I fear I'm going to fail? How do I do that? How do I get to that place in time where I have that kind of courage? This is what I have in my 56 years come to call high spirituality. And others may call it psychology. Others may call it, it's not spirituality at all. I don't know what others may call it. But I think this is high spirituality. This is where I find my cutting edge in working on my spiritual life, dealing with these kinds of issues. That all of us adopt a particular way of life and particular ways of behaving. And if we want to know what we need to change, usually if we ask our partners, we can find out pretty readily. But usually we don't ask our partners because we know if we do, we'll find out pretty readily. I can remember one time speaking and talking about somebody was asking, well, what is it that I do that triggers this and triggers that? And I said, see the other person doing whatever it is you really want them to change. Because they couldn't catch that this was a relational dynamic, that this is a dance we do as communities, as families, and as couples. And I said, and the person said, yeah, I got it. I can see them. I can see them doing it. That's the very thing. And then I said, now stop and turn around and look at yourself, because whatever it is you're doing probably triggered what they're doing. Because it's a relational dynamic, and that's how it works. Okay. So how do we deal with this spiritually? How do we really move toward a hopeful imagination when sometimes I'm caught up in behaviors that lead to a sense of failure or a sense of that's not for me in this life over and over and over again. So by the time I'm 56, I'm done with that. I can't do that anymore. So I settle for something not as desirable or not as good for my own life. So how do I get there? How do I take this story and lifestyle that I am? How do I take that and change it? And understand that as a spiritual transformative process. This may sound, well, it is science as well as spiritual. And it comes from a way of thinking that there are emotional aspects to our lives and there are affective aspects to our lives. And those two are distinctly different. To the point where how really helped me understand that is it was described that the affective dimensions of who we are as beings are biology. Emotional aspects of who we are as human beings, that is biography. Very different. Affect is hardwired in us, gray matter. Emotional life and narrative and biography, that's a little more flexible. And what we will do is that we will take our story as children and take it into adulthood, and we will merge it with our affective life. And that affective life will determine the patterns of how we act. And spirituality is really a question, can we change that? And so I'll read, these are, from one person's perspective, the primary affects that undergird all of our emotional life and all of our relationships. And they are these. And he's got them positive, neutral, and negative. And he said, enjoyment, joy, is a primary affect, the capacity for joy. Interest and excitement, they're primary felt affects. Surprise, to be startled, that's neutral, could be positive or negative. Some people love surprises, just love surprise. You give me surprises. Some people say, you can do anything but surprise me. Don't startle me. Don't say boo coming around the corner. Don't startle me. Because their history takes that neutral response and puts some anxiety or fear to it. Okay? But if somebody's surprised with wonderful things in life and every time they're surprised or startled, good things come, you can surprise me all day long. So that's the neutral, right? And then there's what he terms negative, and I would like to take the negative off that and say these are just our capacities and potential. Anger, enrage, distrust, dismay, distrust, fear, distress, fear, terror, shame, and humiliation. These are affective. These are our capacities of what it means to be human. And if if we could separate them, and if I could just look at these affective states without my story and without my narrative, maybe I could get a handle on that. And so when I look back at my history, has joy been a dominant experience in my life? Or is joy something foreign? Joy something I work toward, but I don't really have? Is anger, fear, are they dominant traits? When I get startled, do I get angry, defensive? When I'm startled, do I get delighted, surprised? When I'm about to do something, do I hesitate because I'm a fear of being exposed and seen and shameful? So when you look back over your history, you can begin to see which affective patterns are dominant. This is going to determine that sense of hopefulness that we bring to our hopes and visions. If joy and excitement do not have a dominant necessarily, let's say at least 50%, because joy and excitement are about the completion of things. Things that I have in my mind that I want to happen. So I get excited about them. I get joyful about them. So then joy is more of a dominant experience in my life. So that when I see a vision for the church, or I see a vision for a relationship, or so when I see that the future, I actually have a belief that it will happen. And when I have a belief that it will happen, my behavior will start coordinated to accomplishing the task. However, if disappointment, hurt, or distrust are more dominant, that when I have a vision for the future, for myself or for others, I will be easily dissuaded. I will be easily put that down. I won't do it. I won't coordinate my behavior to accomplish the task that I want to accomplish that I know is going to make me happy, because of the base from which I come from, the negative affects are stronger. So when I look at my life and I say to myself, man, you have trouble completing tasks. Or, I really don't have any visions, because if I have a vision or an expectation, or if I tell somebody this is what I want, it always gets taken from me. Or what's the sense of wanting something? I don't ever get it anyway. I mean, how many of us do stuff like that? All of us do stuff like that. But the spiritual life, moving toward love and hopefulness, and all the traditions we read say that can be different. There can be a transformative process. But if I'm coming from the negative affects, even so I say yes to that, I don't engage the behavior that will actually make the transformative process happen. Because that's a vision in and of itself. So how do I do that? How do you do that if that's something you would want to incorporate in your meditative prayer or spiritual lives? That kind of transformation to move to where that the affects that undergird our story, the affects that are the foundation of who we are more that excitement and joy. So this is a way, and you can think about that or however you might do that. This is what I really like about Unitarian Universalism. Because hopefully this is not a threat to the beliefs that we have. Beliefs about ourselves, beliefs about others, beliefs about God, beliefs about not God, whatever it might be. That I can say that primarily I have these affects and I can detach my story from it and get an understanding of these affects so that I can begin to work to change them. And I don't have any of my history, of any of my story, directing me on the structure that needs to be. Does that make sense? That I'm not predetermined to choose what those affective patterns are going to be because of the story that I have lived out of. That I can detach my beliefs and I can detach my story and try to get to that affective sense of self without any prejudices. I was reading earlier about a belief that the church had was reading about demons. God, what, you know, what is that? You know? But anyway, and because there's an emergence in the belief of demons and those kinds of things, so I was reading about that. And in the Middle Ages, it was believed that every child was born of a demon because through the birthing process, the demon would get into the child and then the child had to be exorcised. And they would exorcism on every child because of that. I mean, so, but that was the belief. To say to a person who has that belief, no, that's a construct from your emotional life and it's your biography, and you got to really, because that's a fearful belief and a belief that I got a demon in me I'm going to transmit to my child. That's not a positive or joyful belief, and that I can detach that and take a look at my affective structure in life and do a greater sense of joy and excitement and let that belief go. That person's not going to do that right away if they're entrenched in that belief system. If I have a belief that my world is oppressive and when I die I'm going to go to heaven, that if you're going to deal with this spiritual work that mystics have dealt with, Sufis have dealt with, Christian mystics use, and let go of all beliefs, I might have a hard time doing that, because if I let go of the relief that vision of me in heaven has, I may have to face the anxiety and depression of the here and now. So it's not an easy spiritual practice to let go of our belief systems so that we can work with those deeper structures of who we are as human beings, but to have and move in the direction of that hopeful imagination, that hopeful sense of being, that's what I need to do. Because if I don't have it, or if it's weak, or if it's diminished, or if it needs strengthening, and it's not there the way I want it to be there right now, that means my story, my experiences in this world have activated those negative affects and they're dominant in my story and how I present myself to this world. It's just the way it is. So in order for that to change, I've got to let go of those parts of my story, or at least suspend. You can reattach, at least suspend those parts of my story and those belief systems that are activating those negative affects to be dominant. I've got to let that go. And I've got to figure out some way to move into my inner world and care for myself so that the distrust, so that the fearfulness, so that the shame, if they're in there, so that healing can take place, so that the excitement in life and the vitality of life and the joy of life can become dominant. Then when that happens, and it takes work, then when that happens, and I have a vision for this church, for myself, for my relationship, for my family, for my community, my behavior will begin to change in coordination with the vision. That's the spiritual work of developing the hopeful sense of self that we need to do to bring about the visions that we have for ourselves. And I hope we continue to be a place that provides the opportunity to do that kind of work. So when our lay leader says, "I'm lost," that we say, "Aren't we all at times?" Breathe deep. Let's be a place where we can find our place.